It was a great pleasure to catch up with Alvise Sforza Tarabocchia at the University of Kent. Alvise is a lecturer in Italian studies, and in this fascinating interview, we discuss Alvise's love of heavy metal, his degree in philosophy from his native Italy, and why the prospect of doing a PhD in philosophy was not the right path for him. We learn that when he was younger, he wanted to be a surgeon. His mother is a retired academic in the history of medieval art. His father is a civil engineer. And we talk about the change in academic culture, and we ask the big what-if questions. And Alvise explains why he's glad that he didn't become a medical doctor. Now, from childhood, Alvise remembers going fishing with his parents, as well as skiing and playing in a band. And we talk about what happens when one ends up living out someone else's dream. He reveals how he ended up in a heavy metal band and the pleasure involved in that. And we talk about a film, Lords of Chaos, which we have both seen, which is about the founding myth of black metal. We also talk about his interest in film, especially Star Wars. We learn that Spaceballs was the first film that Alvise ever watched at the cinema, and how he has always enjoyed the Pink Panther cartoons. We move on to talk about 1980s gender binaries, about the things that bring us together, as well as issues around conformity. Alvise speaks about the teachers who inspired him. In particular, we learn about the wild religious studies teacher he once had, and we learn how religion played a big part in his upbringing and how he parted ways with his Catholicism. We also talk about the Church of Satan in the United States and whether this can also be classified as a religion. Then in the final part of the interview, we learn why Alvise has always had a problem with the passing of time, why for him looking back is never a positive experience. He talks about whether he is happy with how his life has played out, and why the most radical metal version of himself would be disappointed to see what he is doing now. So what an absolute pleasure for this week's Nostalgia interview to meet Alvise Sforza Tarabocchia. My name is Chris DC. Well, it is such a pleasure this afternoon to have Alvise from the Italian department here at the University of Kent. No, it's lovely.
Thank you very much for having me.
No, it's a real pleasure. And well, I'll cut to the chase now, because I know that at some point, well, I'll make sure it comes up. I know you have an interest in heavy metal. I need to know what, you know, it's sort of like when you've got a colleague who you've known for years, but you suddenly discover that they've got sort of an area of interest that, you know, may be similar to yours or something sort of really unexpected. You think, you know, I want, you know, more than anything else. It was often, I don't know if you find this, Alvise, sometimes when you're at a conference, you meet somebody who is doing something similar to yourself and you have loads in common. But often with your colleagues who you see every day, you have no idea what their research or even sometimes their personal interests are.
Yeah, especially their personal interest. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes, I have. I used to play in a metal band.
We'll save that one. Definitely sounds brilliant. But you've been here about a decade, is that right?
Yes, Kent? A little bit longer than a decade, yes. Yeah. I came here 12 years ago, in 2007. I graduated in philosophy. I have a degree in philosophy from the University of Trieste in Italy, where I was born and grew up. I graduated in 2006, and then I started a PhD in philosophy there, but it sort of felt like an empty parking space, like a place where you stay before being unemployed. And doing a PhD in philosophy in Italy, that was a bit of the feeling I had. And you know, just by chance, to be fair, I went back to my dissertation supervisor in Italy. We have every undergraduate degree, you have to write a dissertation. So I went to my dissertation supervisor office to give him a bottle of something, just to say thank you for having supervised me. And at that point, one of his assistants was sitting behind him. And he said, "Oh, I just received an email from this university of Kent." And I said, "There's someone there who's looking for PhD students. Why don't you apply?" And well, I applied. I deferred my entry for 1 year because I wasn't really sure it was in Italian studies. So I graduated in philosophy, I had no clue whether I wanted to do that or not. But then I had a taste of what a PhD looked like in Italy, and I didn't want to do that. So, yeah. So I came here. Yeah,
it's really funny, isn't it? Because loads of colleagues sometimes have degrees or even PhDs in different subject areas to what they go on to teach. And I see it right across this university, people I've interviewed, and you suddenly discover that they followed a very different sort of course to the one that now they're teaching their students on, you know, very different programs of study. So what about things like earliest memories? So before you even considered doing something like a PhD, what growing up in Italy, what can you remember from when you were young? What are the sort of things that really sort of define you or ground you from childhood?
Oh, well, certainly I think speaking of things we do for a living and what we end up doing, I grew up with the dream of becoming a surgeon. I mean, I that's all I ever dreamed about. All I ever dreamt about. Ever since I was young, ever since I was very, very, very young, and I was convinced I wanted to study medicine up until a couple of months, probably before applying to university. And I remember at that point I was going through a couple of rough years, not only because adolescence in general, but because my grandparents were unwell, my mom was very, very close to them, so it was a pretty sad moment. As I saw lots of doctors, medical doctors in the house going around, and a friend of mine, I remember, asked me, a very close friend of mine, asked me, so you're actually set of for you want to do medicine? And I said, yeah, sure. I will apply for medicine. He said, do you realize that if you study medicine, you'll become a doctor? And stupid as it may sound, that was enlightening for me. I said, yeah, that's true. What I realized is that studying medicine, you can only become a doctor, and that's what you'll ever be. Yeah. The only thing you'll ever be. And instead, I did philosophy, which opens up everything.
And of course, a very different sort of doctor.
You become a very different sort of doctor.
Yeah, although you probably find, like me, that sometimes you phone up about an electricity bill or something, and they say, oh, so you're a doctor, and then you explain that you're not a medical doctor, and they say, well, how did that happen then? And you think, oh, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have started this conversation.
Those sort of things. Yeah. Yeah. No one in an airplane will suddenly scream, we need a doctor in philosophy.
Yes, exactly.
In Italian studies, no, probably not.
Yeah, probably not, you know, important though it is, it may not save lives. It may boost people's, you know, erudition and their sort of sense of, you know, what is sophisticated and what is challenging and provocative, but it may not actually, you know, be a life or death matter. And I would hope not. Anyway, I hope that none of my books have ever, you know, been used in the context of life or death emergencies. But what about things like your parents? What did they do?
My mom was an academic herself. Yeah. She's retired now. She's been retired for quite a bit, and she used to lecture in history of medieval art, and in particular history of manuscript and illumination. My dad is a civil engineer. He sort of attempted to play with retirement for a couple of times, but then he just keeps on working. Yeah. He's 82 now, and he just keeps on working.
You hear that about politicians sometimes as well, that they don't retire in the inverted commas normal way. Because if you spent your whole life working in pressurised environments, or simply you've developed a life structure that works for you, although sometimes you probably think, oh, I can't wait to stop, I can't wait to go on holiday or indeed retire, I guess you never do. I don't know if you remember, but when we still have obviously the national lottery over here, but I remember when the lottery came in 25 or whatever years ago, everybody was like, you know, what will you do then, Chris, when you retire? You know, when you win the lottery, where are you going to go? You know, which boat are you going to sail on, you know, forever? And of course, there's part of me that's like really, that finds that really attractive. But another part of me that says, how long would I last doing that? Because the thought of going on a holiday that never ends, then that suddenly a new structure would develop and you'd need a holiday from that. You probably think, I can't think of anything better, you know, than going to work, you know. so it's funny how sometimes we create our own niches, but I guess when you're in your 40s, the thought of never retiring, you know, probably on one level sounds really scary, but on the other you think, well, the thought of just not doing the sort of thing that you love and have accumulated over many years, especially when you're doing academic study and you're in a certain mindset that you never give up that sort of pursuit, I guess would be really tough.
Yes, I think so. The funny thing is that my dad keeps working, and he's in building and as I said, a civil engineer, whereas my mom, who's on exactly, she used to be an academic, so the sort of thing you might think you want to keep on doing forever, she probably retired. She's been an emeritus for a couple of years after her retirement, and she said, you know what, I think she grew very very disappointed with the way the university evolved. She just was no longer working in the environment she signed up for. And I think more and more colleagues, even here, unfortunately, in the UK, are feeling the same thing right now. So I wouldn't be surprised if we were to see more academics just retire for good at a certain point and not keep on being academics till the day they die, as it used to be the case, I think.
No, I agree with you there, because sometimes what an academic might have been when I was a student and what it was when I entered the profession, what it is now, have changed. And some people have changed with it. Some people have joined the profession after I did and don't know what it was like 20 years ago. And others, you know, when I came here, for example, 15 years ago, there were colleagues double my age who'd been here for decades. And they certainly didn't recognise some of the change of culture that I kind of joined and signed up for. But also, I think I think it's also probably what's precipitated a lot of the nostalgia research. This notion that you enter a profession for a particular reason, a particular passion, and there may come a point when you look back and just say, hang on a minute, is this what I signed up for? Is this what I really want to do? And sometimes evolving is necessary. You can't just do the same thing and say, well, it worked 30 years ago, why shouldn't it work now? Because on that basis, you know, we wouldn't be using computers, or we would, we wouldn't be using PowerPoints, or we'd be writing everything down on paper, and that just doesn't fit anymore. But on the other hand, I think that sometimes it is no bad thing just to say, is this right for me? And I'm not very good at asking those sort of questions. At least I can ask them, but I don't tend to. If I'm in a particular sort of what I see as my comfort zone, I tend to stay there and make it work rather than say, let me do something different.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, that's the reason why I didn't apply for medicine. That's exactly the reason why. All of a sudden, I realized, who am I to decide for myself or for the rest of my life? I want to be open to whatever comes next. And it's not to say that I didn't embark on a consistent and coherent career, or that I'm not on a trajectory and just adrift in the sea of life. On the contrary. But that, at that point it felt that deciding once and for all what I was going to be at that point was too scary.
And I find sometimes that when you don't know what's in front of you, that could be exhilarating, because it's sort of, you know, the options are still open. On the other hand, there are dreams that I had when I was 4 or 5 years old. You know, I wanted to do something in radio, and that never left me. And I'm very conscious that doing this sort of this podcast, it's almost as though I'm sort of chasing the dream that has always been there. But now finally, you know, middle age, you know, I start acting on that. But it is funny when you sometimes look back and see almost these patterns. And the way we look for patterns, I guess, sometimes we think, oh, it's meant to be. But sometimes, you know, they are there, that you clearly have particular interests or passions or skills or talents. And I see it in my own children, certainly, that, you know, that they're almost there doing the same sort of things at the age of 6 or 7. And I think, gosh, I didn't have that sort of confidence. That if, you know, I sort of feel that what might be effortless for them, you know, for me just didn't seem like something I could do. Like, you know, radio was like, how on earth do you enter that? But it just seems that sometimes if you've really got a passion, you should go with it. And I love the job that I do here, but I, the back of my mind is always that, you know, that there may be another calling and may still be another calling, but how on earth that translates into, you know, doing something different, I don't know. But it's interesting that you had that, but you made a decision which has obviously worked out very well for you. But I guess, you know, you may not still want to be a surgeon now. Maybe you do, but there's always that sort of niggling question. Yeah.
Well, I did, towards the end of my PhD, I think it was nagging me, what if, well, you know, you're facing the great unknown after the PhD and job uncertainty and everything. And then I thought from a negative point of view, the very same thought that I had at that point. What if at that moment I had decided that by not embarking in a medical career, what if at that point I decided that I would be forever not a doctor, not a medical doctor. Yeah. I would be forever a failed medical doctor. And then he passed. I found a job and I'm very happy. So he just went away. And I, comparing myself to others who did embark around my age in a medical career, you see that it's a very, very harsh profession, very harsh. They're really mistreated, medical doctors at this point. It's awful.
No, and I was always, I remember actually meeting one of my school friends in a hospital when my dad was in hospital many years ago, over 20 years ago, and I recognised him straight away. I suppose it was probably, you know, less than a decade after we'd previously seen each other. And he asked me what I was doing, and I said I was doing a PhD. But there was a part of me that felt almost a little guilty, because it almost felt as though I was indulging these amazing passions. I could do research on anything I chose. I could find out where the literature was, or indeed, in my case, the films. And I sort of thought it was a labour of love. But of course, yeah, I wasn't earning any money doing it, because I was studying for a PhD. But you know, he was doing a very high-powered job. And he was, you know, no doubt absolutely loved it, but you could really see that what he was doing, and because at that point I wasn't working in this, well, I was doing some part-time teaching, but, you know, I was still a student, and you know, he was probably a junior doctor, but you could really see how big that was. But also, I could never do anything like that. Yeah. So, you know, part of me also just thought, he's probably doing what he wants to do. I'm on a different sort of journey, but hopefully, and of course, you know, I was probably more early to mid 20s at the time. You never quite know where you're going to end up, but you kind of know sometimes that there are some career routes that just, you know, don't have your name on them.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. And what about, we mentioned, you know, childhood memories, but what about things you enjoyed doing as a child? You know, whether, I mean, music or film or any particular activities that you did?
Well, we used to go fishing with my parents, quite a bit. I did enjoy that, and I did enjoy a lot going skiing, going in the mountains in general. Yeah. Being in the mountains, it was really a festive moment for me. I used to play. My mum, among other things, she used to be. She played the harpsichord, as a young child, I think it was five, I started having private classes, studying to play the keyboards in general. But I started with the harpsichord because we had a harpsichord at home. That's the funny thing, and I ended up playing in a band, and I enjoyed it immensely. But I don't think music had my name written on it, really, because at a certain point, we stopped playing with the band, we remained friends, but we stopped playing together. And I realized at that point that I didn't miss it at all. I'm not playing anything at the moment. For me, music, strangely, was always very, very mathematical, and I got very frustrated if I didn't manage to If I didn't manage to express the music like I wanted to, if I stumbled into, you know, physical or technical difficulties of sorts, which you do by playing, and it was much more of a frustrating experience than a pleasant one. And I played for 20 years probably.
I found that because I always had this love of music, certainly music that I would listen to on the radio, that doing a GCSE in music would be the obvious thing to do. I hated it. It took all the love out of it because I never lost my enthusiasm for... I think maybe that's the thing. My love was for radio. And although I would listen to music on the radio, I was clearly listening to radio as a medium. And it wasn't just the music, it was the presenters, it was the whole kind of relationship, and very social relationship, personal relationship that a radio can conjure up, can evoke. So I was doing music, but yeah, you'd have learning time signatures and we'd be doing lots of Mozart and, you know, very important stuff, but also kind of wasn't really what I was interested in. And it was the science of music, and it was kind of a mathematical exercise actually. I wasn't in the right mindset for that, and so there was always that strange disparity between sort of saying, oh, I love music but I hate studying music. And I did the piano as well and really got a few grades, but just didn't really, it never took off. And I kind of thought I'd go to the piano teacher every week and knew that I was making limited progress because I just didn't have the interest in it. But at school, in some ways, I was, you know, sensing that I was thriving in some areas. And that's just it. I think if you, at the age of 4 or 5, if you've got an older sibling, as I did, you think, oh, I want to do what she's doing. She's playing the piano. I want to learn the piano. But then before long, you think, actually, no, maybe that was her dream. And it's not mine.
And I grew, well, I'm an only child, so I didn't have siblings with whom to relate. But yeah, I very much agree. At a certain point, I realized that playing an instrument was not my dream, it was my dad's dream. Definitely.
Yeah. I agree. And the heavy metal interest, though, you said...
Oh, the heavy metal, yeah.
Was that the band when you played for 20 years? Is that the band you're thinking of?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. We started with a group of friends, you know, probably the social rejects of the class, of the cohort of students playing metal, you know, the whole sort of... antisocial behavior the Americans would look at, would frown upon and consider a social alarm, role-playing games, Dungeons and Dragons, fantasy and horror films, and listening to heavy metal, and then playing, of course, heavy metal, and all those things matured together when we were 16, 17, and then it became more mature. We became better players, less interested in the rebellious side of metal and more interested in actually the pleasure of playing together and making music.
Because I saw a film, I think we both saw a film on different nights, because I put it up on Facebook and you were seeing that the day before. I forget its title, but it was about a heavy metal band and some of
a
the
black metal band, I guess. Was it I can't remember the title either. It's a fiction film. It's not the documentary, because I also watched a documentary about black metal.
Yeah, it was a sort of faux documentary, or at least it was, I think, maybe based on true experiences of an American band. And it was all about some of the interests that some of the band members were pursuing, the macabre interests. And they ended up, one of them ended up murdering some of the others.
Oh, no, it's a Norwegian band. I mean,
they're a Norwegian band.
The Mayhem. The band is called Mayhem.
That's it.
The one who killed himself, his stage name was Dead, and the stage name Euronymous, I can't remember the real name.
No, you're right, because in killing himself,
Varg Vikernes, the Burzum stage name Burzum, ended up killing Euronymous. Yes,
that was the one.
The founding myth of black metal.
Yes, and because he killed himself, then suddenly the interest in the band went up, and of course there were some people who were joining the band because they perhaps were more interested in the publicity that they could get out of that. So it was like, oh, well, if I slice the death, you know, and the film showed us this in great grotesque detail, but in committing these acts, there was, you know, the sense that it would make the news. And so there was the sort of, is it the integrity of the band? Is it the music? Or is it what you can get out of that? And so the film actually had lots of layers to it, but I was the only one in the auditorium when I saw it. Obviously, I say you saw it another night.
It's a niche.
And I was aware that the usher came in at one point. You know, they come in every like half an hour just to make sure that no one's up to no good. And it was just me in there. I think he came in at just the moment when some like, really horrible thing that I could barely watch. And I wasn't even like, able to look at the screen. So he must have thought, you know, there's only one person watching this. He's not even watching the film. He's sort of like, you know, trying to do everything not to be violently ill. So that's interesting. Because what about things like the charts, though? Because when I was younger, I was just obsessed with all the sort of, you know, the latest sounds, the latest, you know, what people, the sort of records that people were buying. I don't know, growing up in Italy, whether you had any sort of similar experiences, but music was so foundational when I was growing up.
Yeah, well, it wasn't that foundational for me, because my parents were never particularly interested in contemporary music. They're still very fond of classical music. Yeah. So I end up, when they listened to music, it was mostly classical music. So I was never up to date at all with charts or everything. I still get mocked sometimes because, you know, being in Italian studies, we have a module on Italian music, and I end up teaching the part on singer-writers of the 70s. But I listen to them on my own as a grown-up, never while growing up, really. So I was completely out of the loop. But instead, what's interesting, I think, is when I grew into, let's say, heavy metal, and I got fond of heavy metal, sort of the same thing applied, because, you know, you frown upon the pop music climbing the charts, exactly musicians not being musicians but just popping out songs that appeal the bigger audiences. And then in the end, the very same thing happens in the niches of heavy metal, black metal, death metal. There are the posers, there are the true metal heads. The bands that one should listen to because that is proper metal, and the other thing is not proper metal. If it climbs the charts, it's not death metal enough because it's it has to be exactly niche. And then the film showed it very well how it was very. It was very controversial, basically, to balance these two aspects.
Yeah, because I was at a conference some years ago where, and she's now written a book actually on this very thing. But Frances Stewart, who I've interviewed for this podcast, is doing some work on punk rock and wrote a book called "Punk Rock Is My Religion," and she was telling me about how. Particularly with, you had the Undertones, who were from Northern Ireland in the early 80s, who were like massive. And then Fergal Sharkey, their lead singer, went down a more popular route. He had a number one single in the mid 80s with a love song called A Good Heart, It's Hard to Find. And of course, the punk community in Northern Ireland sort of thought, you know, hang on a minute, you know, what you've just done is utterly outside, you know, so it's that whole sense of apostasy almost, you know, you're going against a particular, you know, heritage that, you know, you were defined and you were made through your involvement with a particular type of music, and now you've walked away from that. And she said that, you know, a lot of people really, you know, even hearing his name, you know, it's sort of like, you know, he's a traitor. And I find that really fascinating because many people's musical interests will evolve, but you are right. When I was at school, the sort of music that I was interested in, which I guess I still am, which was far more sort of chart stuff, but there were some people, you know, there was the purists who would be listening to it. In some cases, it was a lot of heavy metal, actually, and there was that clear sort of condescending sort of, you know, attitude that if I was into something a bit more sort of, you know, Eurovision type sort of music, it was clearly it's a lesser type of music. And so I always grew up in that kind of mindset, but now I find it just hilarious because, you know, I kind of feel I haven't really changed much, but the things that I listened to then are very much things that I will hear very much on the radio, particularly on nostalgia-related radio programmes. When you hear it back, you think, yeah, that really sums me up at a particular time. And I sort of thought, I stuck to my guns. I didn't pretend to like something that because it was cool, and it's what everybody else in the class was listening to. Yeah. But we all have those sort of dynamics. But then again, I never joined a band.
It was just
on the radio. What about things like film, though? Because was that big when you were growing up? Were you interested in films?
Yes, definitely. Well, I wouldn't say interested as in... having critical look at films, but I was very fond of a number of films in particular. I remember Star Wars and the first trilogy, of course. I was completely captivated by Star Wars. I can't remember how many times I watched them.
Actually, at the cinema as well.
No, I was too young for watching them at the cinema. The first one is 77 even earlier. No, I was born in 1981.
So. Oh, good heavens!
I watched them when they were already dated films, probably for the first time. But I was very, very fond, very, very fond of them. The first film that I ever watched at the cinema was Spaceballs.
Mel Brooks.
Yeah. I was 5 or 6. I went with my parents. What became for several years one of my best friends, and his family, and the funny thing, nobody understood anything because it's not really a film for children. There are a number of explicit jokes and maybe not scenes. I can't remember, but it was a bit bizarre. And all the references to Star Wars, which is the only thing that film is about, were completely lost on all of us, because none of us, including my friends, I suppose, ever watched Star Wars. Mm. I think, I don't know, our parents just assumed it would be a funny film to watch with children. Maybe, you know, it was the 80s.
Yeah,
no rating and all sort of things.
Because I went with I very rarely went to the cinema. In fact, my love of cinema started at university, but I did go with my mum, actually, bizarrely, one Sunday when I would have been about 13, not even that. We saw one of the Police Academy movies, like Police Academy 4. And this is the funny thing, because it clearly wasn't exactly aimed at children, but it obviously had a rating that was just about accessible. You know, it must have been PG. I don't even think the 12 rating was in those days. So went to see this, but of course I was cringing even at that age I could understand there were a lot of references, shall we say, that were a little bit embarrassing. And it's one of those sort of moments when you're sitting with your mother at the age of 13, just thinking, what am I doing here? And it's like I was just like cringing and going very red, I think, at that time, as 13-year-olds do when something to do with sex or whatever is sort of put up on the screen. But it's interesting, though, isn't it? But it's those formative experiences. I mean, do you still watch Spaceballs now, or is it something that you just remember?
I think I went back to it. I watched it, it was funny. I laughed at it. I laughed with it in a much more aware way, because I had watched Star Wars, so I grasped the references.
Because I found sometimes that those films that I watched when I was really young, and I guess same for music as well, sometimes they're in your DNA. You can't get away from them.
Oh no, you can't.
What you said about Mel Brooks, I saw on an old black and white TV when I was at university his what was the Hitchcock? Well, High Anxiety, and it was obviously a spoof of Vertigo and probably every Hitchcock film. And I was watching that once on TV, and I remember thinking, "God, this is actually quite gripping." Because it was billed in the Radio Times as a comedy, a spoof. But I thought, "God, this is actually a really effective sort of thriller." But of course, at that point, I'd seen that before, in the same way that you saw Spaceballs before Star Wars.
Yes.
I saw High Anxiety before the Hitchcock films, and of course after seeing The Real Thing, as it were, part of me also thought maybe High Anxiety would disappoint me, because that sort of, I was only probably saw 20 minutes of it one evening on TV. But again, it's those things that you watch, and it doesn't matter if people say, oh, that's a really bad film, or in the case of music, or that's a load of nonsense, why would you listen to that, because it's something that you associate with a particular period in your life, it kind of everything else indissoluble.
It stays with you, absolutely.
Yeah.
I can't bear anyone criticizing Star Wars. Yeah. I mean, it's important. Yeah. There's nothing to criticize about those films. I mean, they're my psyche probably shaped around them. And the other big thing, going further back, way before Star Wars, one of my favorite characters ever, I think, was the Pink Panther. And that must have been when I was. I don't remember a time when I wasn't aware that the Pink Panther existed. So I think it must have been ever since I was born. I was shown Pink Panther cartoons and animation and so forth. And I remember very much being mocked at a primary school because, you know, the Pink Panther is pink, and, you know, it was the 80s in Italy, and a male could not really like anything that was pink for one reason or the other. So I struggled a lot until I found out in a comic book of the with the Pink Panther as the subject, that the Pink Panther is actually male. And it was very, at that time when I was 6, 7 or something, was very important that my character of reference had to be a male.
You are right, because there were all of these binaries in the 80s. Boys wore blue and girls pink. But the Pink Panther, because I wasn't sure at first whether you were going to mention the Inspector Clouseau, you know, because I, like you in that sense, grew up with the cartoons.
Yes.
And then there was only somebody, and I think also the score was also done by the same, Blake Edwards did the films, didn't he? But Henry Mancini did the score.
Yeah.
But the cartoon and the films, obviously, they were related. But, you know, for a whole generation, watching, you know, in half terms, I used to keep a diary. And I used to mainly write a diary in the half term. Probably like, oh, I'm not in school this week, therefore I must, you know, film my time. Oh, I'll write everything that I'm doing. And it was just almost like a list of TV programmes. And it's always like the Pink Panther or the Flintstones or, you know, stuff. And it's kind of funny, but there was a certain innocence there, because we all, you know, be on at 10 in the morning or something, and, you know, it'd be a real talking point. So, you know, we grew up on the same cartoons, we loved the same things at school, we all, the common interests, and I think that was the funny thing. We might have private experiences in terms of we all watch the TV to get on our own, maybe with our families, but then we want to share the experience of that when next we met. So it was almost as though we'd be watching it and thinking, oh, so-and-so will like that, or my friend will enjoy that scene, or I bet they laughed at that joke or something. And it really brought us together.
Oh, yes, yeah. But that happened, for me, it happened later on in life. I think between 10, after 10 years old, 10, 11, something like that, when we started watching let's say more or less proper TV series. I remember the big thing was the X-Files. Have you watched the last episode of X-Files? Oh, this happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
This happened to Dana Skelly. Yeah.
I had somebody knocking on my door once.
Yeah.
Because I think, pretty sure it was the X-Files in sort of mid-ish 90s. And someone said, I normally go over to my friend's house, but it's a bit of a wet, it's a dark evening. And I just thought, I know you've got a TV. Do you mind if I watch it, you know, do you mind if I watch it with you? And I was like, I've never watched it before in my life, but yeah, okay, let's see what it's all about. But you're right, it brought everyone together.
It doesn't, yeah, indeed, it does bring everyone together, yeah.
Yeah.
And then every time something brings people together, it also marginalizes others, because there are the outsiders who don't watch it. And with the X-Files, it was easy, because I really loved it.
Yeah.
But then there were other things, like Beverly Hills or Melrose Place at a certain point was a big thing, apparently, in Italy. And that I remember I watched it, but I didn't enjoy it particularly. I think it was much more to fit in, to have something to talk about.
No, but I've spoken to people who do research on, like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and they grew up with that at a certain age when they were not. I mean, I suppose Buffy had a huge following, but it also appealed to a lot of people who kind of felt like outsiders, which is, you know, in keeping with the character and the program. And she was telling me, I think she's in Iceland or Finland, I can't remember, where she's doing some research, and she was telling me that now, 20 years and more than that on. You know, they're in their 30s and 40s. But although they have, you know, regular jobs and families, and they do all the sort of things that people have to do as grown-ups, pay their mortgage and, you know, go and work. But she said that what defines them is not their work, even in some cases their families, but they'll go on those online forums where people who watched Buffy in the mid-90s and all these years later still feel that this, you know, that this is who they are, and they're identifying with people who have a similar sort of mindset. And she said that, you know, this is huge, that it's sort of like that is the thing that keeps them going, because it, wow, you know, they felt outsiders in the 90s and they sort of grew up with this. And so it's a lot of people who, you know, the opposite of what we were just saying about everybody watched certain the same programs, but those who perhaps felt that they didn't fit in with their friends at school, or they felt a little bit on the periphery of those sort of social groups, you know, they weren't the A-list, then suddenly all these years later, no matter which country or continent they're in, they're all, you know, these alliances are formed, and it sort of, it gives them a real sense of purpose, identity, and over the years almost it sustained them in fellowship.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think it happens also with the other big thing with outcasts and outsiders, those not, as you said very well, those not on the A-list, they're role-playing games, Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like this. But now nerd is the new cool, but it didn't used to be the case.
No, you're right. I really realised that one year when one of our students here in religious studies said, she said, "Oh, I'm really enjoying the course." She said, I think she sort of lowered her voice a bit. She said, "You know what?" She said, "I think I'm a bit of a religious studies nerd." And I thought, well, that's a great thing to say. You know, in this office, you know, that's the best thing. But also be proud of that anyway. You know, you don't have to just sort of like almost lower your voice, because that, you know, well, why not? Good for you. You found your calling, your purpose. You're loving what you're doing. Isn't that better than just sort of conforming to, you know, I've never been into sport really. And I was always aware that in Wales, particularly, there'd be a big match on, you know, football or rugby. And it would kind of pass me by because it just wasn't my sort of thing. But I was very aware that sometimes, you know, people would be very drunk, sometimes later for an evening, or there'd be lots of flag waving, but I was just, you know, different mindset altogether. But that, but, you know, good for them and good for me. But that's right. You know, it didn't always feel quite that balanced, you know, in those days. So you've already said, Alvise, about how you ended up becoming an academic. But what about things like teachers who inspired you, either at school or at university? What sort of influences were there on your life?
Oh well, it's a funny question. It's a funny question because I have a weird funny answer. I can't remember very really inspiring teachers in my childhood or while growing up really. I had a decent teacher in primary school. She was okay, but nothing peculiar. And sixth form and intermediate, the three intermediate years before high school, we had lots of different teachers, and they were all right, but nothing peculiar. And at high school, there were ups and downs. Great, nice teachers, but no one that really stood out. And I said, "Oh, this is why I became I became a teacher. This is why I did it." Mm-hmm. And at university, my dissertation supervisor, he's a sort of one of the important living continental philosophers in Italy. He's one of the three founders of weak thought, the pensiero debole, with Vattimo and Galimberti. Rovati, he was an entertaining teacher, and a good teacher at that, but yeah, a bit brutal to be really inspiring, I think. And the others had a very nice, very a rather crazy lecturer in religious studies. Yeah. I did the module in religious studies. It was called the History of Religion, and she was completely out of her mind. Yeah, I remember at the very first class we started. The module was on the monographic module, that was the structure we had in Italy, was on oracles, I think, and we. we started talking about I can't even remember, but it must have been something like I don't know, Bronze Age sort of inscriptions, and we ended up talking about the internet, and I had notes, and I had no clue where how we got there really. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. I can't really put my bet on any of my former teachers as
because I guess sometimes it's the teachers who don't necessarily play by the rules, who for good or ill can sometimes define you, and either because you think I want to be like them, or you think I don't want to be like them, or I want to do something differently. Because the teachers who taught me, some of them were amazing, and the ones who taught the curriculum, you know, sometimes, you know, some of them were brilliant, but sometimes, you know, people might say, oh, it was a really dull subject or whatever, I don't like that class. But the teachers who went off message were often the ones who were deeply popular. But the trouble is, looking back as somebody who works in education, you think, gosh, you know, they really did go off message. We just have debates all the time, you know, what are your views on this? And it helped us. And to be fair, I think we remembered them and we were passionate about them. So the teacher, in no way is it a criticism. We had to do it with an English teacher particularly. But I remember thinking that we did read books, but we spent a lot of time debating and debating things that weren't necessarily directly related to the novels or plays that we were studying. But the fact that they stand out in my mind, perhaps on balance, means that it was good that we did that. And often it was like the last class in the afternoon. So maybe we sort of needed that at 3:30 or whatever time it was. Whereas it had been 9 in the morning, we would have to have been a bit more focused in a different sort of way. But again, you look back and the teachers who you think were amazing, perhaps taught in ways that, as you, is somebody who works very much with a very clear curriculum, I think, God, if I did that with my students, I'd feel that, you know, they would be a bit disappointed, a bit angry sometimes, because they're like, you know, but you're not teaching us the right stuff. You're just sort of just, you know, going off on one sort of thing. You know, if you're not prepared your class, that's what I'd feel anyway.
Yeah.
But it's interesting what those influences are or are not, and how they, you sometimes say, right, you know, I'm not going to be that sort of lecturer.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Yeah. In particular, I thought at the time it was sort of hilarious, but now that I am in education, I can just, well, cringe is the least I can do in reaction to that. It was the very first year of high school, and I remember the teacher of the Italian literature teacher, he was giving a receipt test, I think, in class. It was, there was nothing organized. There was this student in the front row of seats doing their thing, and we were at the back doing the rest of the class normally, and the person in question couldn't really understand the question or something, and this guy just got incredibly angry. He took a dictionary and threw it at the back of the class, and just he said, I'm walking out, I'm done with this. And he just walked out and went to smoke a cigarette. I was just at the time, I remember half of the class saw it as rather funny, well, because we were not the subjects of that rage, but certainly in hindsight, I can say I didn't want to become that sort of teacher.
No, and the way that some teachers who taught me were very bad sometimes at controlling the class, and the class would take advantage of that. They knew that they could wind up the teacher, and the teacher would make all sorts of threats.
Oh yeah.
But never act on them. It'd always be like, you know, you must go down to the head, you know, if you're naughty again, you'll go down to the headmaster. But they were never sent.
Yeah,
maybe they were sometimes sent outside the room for 1 minute, and then they were brought back in. So that was the ultimate. And they knew that if that was the ultimate punishment, the threat, the fear, the so-called fear of the threat, but not the actual carrying out of it, then of course it didn't. So nothing changed. The dynamics never changed. But then when I went to sixth form and the same teacher taught me, I saw a very different sort of teacher, because she was with just a handful of us and we all wanted to study religious studies. And this really sort of almost like sometimes sarcastic side would come out. She'd almost sort of like, you know, be quite open about our ability sometimes, and sort of say, oh, you know, somebody once came into the classroom who'd been one of her students in the previous year, and he'd said, "Oh, so, you know, we were sitting there. So what's the class like? You know, how are your A-level class?" She said, "Oh, you know, compared to a few years ago, not very good, really." And we're like, "I beg your pardon," you know. So it's like, you know, so this teacher who we always associated with being sort of, you know, bullied by the other pupils, you know, turned out to be have a pretty caustic side. She more than held her own, you know, in a different sort of context. But obviously, growing up in Italy as well, politics, religion, you know, when you were a student or otherwise, I mean, were these sort of really big things you couldn't escape from?
Yes, well, definitely. Religion in particular, and it's funny because I've I'm baptized, of course. I did the Holy Communion, the confirmation, the whole process with, and I went through catechism and all sorts of things. And at school we had, because it's very different in Italy. Up until the whole high school, you don't really choose your subjects almost at all. You can choose a sort of specialism in high school, but it's a scientific path, classical, technical. But at the end of the day, you end up doing 8, 9, 10 different subjects, and don't choose them all the time. And one of these is a leftover of a fascist agreement. It's the religion hour. You don't do history of religion, you don't do anything, it's catechism basically. And I always did that up until my very last year in high school, when I grew fonder of heavy metal, and therefore I parted ways with my religious upbringing. And I always did that. I did my catechism, and we went to church during my catechism at least every Sunday. I even went that's one of my most traumatic experiences. I even did 2 years of Boy Scout with the Catholic the Catholic Boy Scout group, and I did the whole thing. And all of a sudden, it turns out that a couple of years ago, maybe 10 years ago, I discovered that my parents were doing that just because they were thinking that it was the right way to bring me up. And they were not practicing Catholics. They didn't believe that much. I mean, it was just the thing that you did. So I just grew up with the idea that my parents were very religious, whereas they were not. And it was one of those things from which you didn't really escape in Italy. You were brought up a Catholic, and I remember in the final years of high school, like, expressing different views, immediately took on a very rebellious shape. It wasn't an environment where we could discuss different views. In the end, there was Catholicism, and the rest was automatically antagonizing. So then it was very easy to just
because I went to a church school, an Anglican church school in Wales, but I then found that it's only when I went to university to study that very subject, or study theology, that all these doors were open, because suddenly I thought, well, you know, so I channeled all my interest into the research. And so I stopped being an observer, taking part in observances, or, you know, going to church. That kind of waned, because I suddenly found, well, the questions that made me interested in the subject, I could kind of get from the academic study, and nobody was saying, you're not allowed to ask those questions. Whereas I did find sometimes in a church environment, just sometimes it felt that it was much about the procedure, and it was about the ritual, and it was about the process. And in a way, I felt that it wasn't a great learning experience. And for some people, of course, it shouldn't be a learning experience. They're not there to be educated in theology. But maybe I was sort of going there because I knew it was a subject that I was deeply interested in. But but I soon found my calling through academic study. So just interesting that sort of my interest in church was there, but it was more study of the church, perhaps, rather than the church itself, that kind of made those interests into something that I could do something with later on.
Sure, yeah. Sure. No, for me it was very, very, very different, yeah. I think. It was a very, very passive sort of exposure to religion, yeah. up until a certain point when, yeah. the only alternative was rebellion.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. And I find that now, because obviously I teach religious studies, and often this issue comes up a lot of the time, the sort of sense that religion is still associated for a lot of people, including the punk work I was mentioning, Francis Stewart. You know, a lot of practicing punk, shall we say, will sometimes say, oh, you know, religion has got nothing to do with punk, because they associate religion with something that might be a bit, you know, something that held them back, and it might be something that, you know, whereas religion, you know, can do something different. But of course, if by religion you mean a particular type of upbringing or particular church you may have gone to, then that association, yeah. is there. But if somebody says, well, punk rock could be your religion, it's like, oh, but that word doesn't seem to fit in that context. Of course, everything that they say, yeah. Suggests that indeed that it is their religion, but they may not use that language, but it's how they feel about somebody else then interpreting what they're saying through a particular lens.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Have you watched the documentary that came out recently, Hail Satan?
Oh, I've heard of it.
Yeah, yeah. It's really good.
Yeah.
Well, as a documentary, it's not exceptional, but the things it shows, it's quite interesting. It's about the Church of Satan, yeah. in the United States, and of course having played in a black metal band, the fascination with, yeah. Satanism and alternate cults always cropped up, and it informed the lyrics of course, it informed the appearance, but that's the thing. It is a religion. It is a religion, the same as any other religion. It is a religion that is based, let's say, I'm not using technical terms here because it's not my field, but it's a religion that uses the same Catholic or Christian pantheon, only the other way around. But in this documentary, Hail Satan, what comes out, which is quite interesting, it's that despite abiding by the same, believing in the same pantheon, it actually tries to move the object of veneration from the goodwill of God to a certain extent to oneself, actually, yeah. to venerate oneself. Absolutely. and that's where, yeah. they try to distinguish themselves.
No, absolutely. And you mentioned Star Wars earlier, but with my students just in the last few weeks in religion and film, and at the open day that we just had on the weekend, talking about Star Wars and Jediism and religious groups or movements which George Lucas may or may not sanction, but in a way it doesn't matter, because they've been created out of what he produced, and for them they have their own sort of meaning systems and rituals.
Yeah absolutely. Their religiosity, their way of approaching, but just simply a higher purpose, a higher power. Yeah.
But a few more philosophically based questions, although, okay. As we start to round off, Alvise, would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones as you look back over your whole life and career?
You know, when I thought a lot about this interview, because I always had a problem with nostalgia. I always had a problem with time passing, and for me it is still a great problem to relate to the fact that we are we don't spend eternity on Earth, and that we are our time is limited, and therefore looking back, all my memories are certainly predominantly positive in their contents, but looking back for me is never positive. I mean, when I have to look back, I always suffer a little. That's the nostalgia is a very good word because it's an ache. It's there is something that aches every time I have to look back. So even though I look back at positive, mostly positive memories, I had a very, very good childhood with all, you know. I'm also very fond of Freud and psychoanalysis, so even if it is positive, it's certainly negative somehow. But still, I mean, in objective terms, it was a very positive, positive childhood, a very happy childhood, and a very good relationship with my parents and everything. Having to look back at it, even though I don't miss it, I wouldn't go back. I like being being who I am. I would never look back, but still having to look back at it, there's an ache there. That's not really longing or desire to go back. It's just a painful awareness that time passes. And therefore, every memory is bittersweet in its nature for me.
Yeah, and I think that notion of that longingness, the melancholy that comes with perhaps a past that cannot be recreated. But some people try that, and I guess, sometimes I have re-listened to old radio programs, or, you know, we were talking about watching films again. Sometimes I've been struck how, you know, if I was listening to that now, my excitement would be there, but of course I'm maybe excited about something that was broadcast as a live radio program in the 1980s, for example. But I can see why it would appeal to me, that there's something that resonates. And sometimes I think, gosh, you know, it was better in those days. You know, it's funny, isn't it? Before social media, radio, you know, the best social media was through radio. Now you can do it on your own, on Facebook. You know, you don't have to wait for the DJ to play your favourite record. You can put it up on YouTube or whatever yourself, and all your Facebook friends can listen to it if they so desire. But you are right, that there is something about the past which means that sometimes we kind of feel that those pathways that we did or didn't take may or may not have been the right ones for us. And I think that often is what it comes down to, that sense of completion or lack of completion, and whether you've, this is one of my other questions, whether it's, whether you've fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young. I mean, do you feel that, in a way, we talked about, you know, being a surgeon, how do you feel about what, you know, in terms of where you are now, looking back, how do you feel that has all played out for you?
That it played out very well. I think it played out very well. I don't. If I look back at any point, I wouldn't have taken different choices, because they landed me here, and I'm happy here. I wouldn't have done anything differently, really. So no, I have no regrets.
And do you think your younger self would be surprised at what you're doing?
Very
now?
Surprised, very surprised, definitely. Yeah.
Not just because of the surgeon, but I suppose also living in Canterbury, I guess, well, for me, I mean, you've travelled a bit further than me, but if you'd said to me 20 years ago, you know, one day you'll be living and working in Kent, that would just seem so strange, because it's got, you know, I've got no family here, no ties here, but obviously I came here because of the work. But if I'd gone down a different career path, you know, it's very unlikely to imagine that I'd be here.
I would be very surprised, definitely very surprised. I don't know, maybe my most radical metal the most radical metal version of me would be a bit disappointed that I'm part of a system, the system of higher education. I don't know, but surprised, definitely.
And are you still in touch with friends from your past?
With some of them we're very close. I'm in touch, and I'm still good friends with all of the other members of the band. One of them is very good and very successful fashion photographer, and we are, I can safely say, he's my best friend. And the other two, one of them is a lecturer in an entirely different subject here in Britain, and he keeps playing black metal, and he keeps publishing, self-publishing on Apple Music and Spotify, the tracks, and he has a solo band, and the other one is still a musician. He's a realtor in my hometown, a musician. But I have many other friends from my childhood with whom we keep in touch. We recently had the second the 20th, yeah, the 20th anniversary of our high school, of our A level. Yes, yeah. So we had the reunion. We were almost all of us were there.
Yeah,
I wasn't. I'm not in touch with all of my high school friends, but a number of friends from childhood.
Yeah, and it does take a while sometimes to you know, reunions are not something I could have done 20 odd years ago. Yeah. But now I feel I'm in the right sort of mindset. And maybe it's also that sense of being comfortable in your own skin and doing what you're doing. Because, as I say, with the friend I met in the hospital many years ago, where he was training to be a doctor, at that point I was still in a stage of sort of becoming. I was doing a PhD,
sure,
but I was in a sort of, you know, there is an outcome here, but I'm not there yet. So I didn't want to go to the world and say, look, I'm doing a PhD, so why would you do that? But now I can sort of say, you know, I'm doing lots of things that I really like and define me. But at that point, it was more a case of, ask me again in 5 years' time.
Yes, yeah.
My very last question, Alvise, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
That's a very difficult question. Well, I have, if I were to be honest, I look back, but not with regret. But my sight is always drawn towards the past, and not to reassess it, but to reminisce. I tend to reminisce a lot, and that's that's among the problems, probably both a symptom and a cause of my issues with time passing.
Yeah. But it has been so wonderful to let time pass this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.